You're listening to Now I've Heard Everything, interviews from the 80s, 90s, and 2000s with voices from the past.
This is the Cousin Brucey rock and roll cycle. Life happens. The poets laud it. The journalists report it. The artists record it. Cousin Brucey exports it.
Radio DJ Cousin Brucey. Today on Now I've Heard Everything, I'm Bill Thompson. Well, over the last few decades, entire libraries full of books have been written about the history of rock and roll. Now, where do you even start with something like that? How do you wrap your arms around such an enormous undertaking? And how do you keep everything in the proper context of culture and society and politics and everything else? Well, perhaps few people may be as well equipped to do that as disc jockey Bruce Morrow, known to his millions of listeners as Cousin Brucey. His 2009 book was called Rock and Roll, and the Beat Goes On. When I sat down and talked with him a few years ago, we talked about the music, of course, but the culture and the society and the politics and all the rest, as well as the careers that he helped shape. So here now, from 2009, Bruce Morrow, Cousin Brucey.
It's a book, I call it kind of a scrapbook of my life. This was all my emotion. The first book of this series was called Doo-Wop. And Doo-Wop came out about a year and a half, 2 years ago. Still doing very well, I might add, very proudly. And that was really about how contemporary music developed. And I started way back before the Civil War, believe it or not. And I just followed it through. And it was an amazing, amazing adventure for me to find out where music came from. When the slaves came over with that horrific time in our history's our nation's history, and field hollers and the development of gospel. And we went into the big band era and pop music. And then something called vocal harmony developed, late 40s. So I did that, and then into rock and roll called Doo-Wop, which is vocal harmony of the 50s, and early rock and roll. This book takes off at 1963. Now, Doo-Wop, I felt I had to write. Let me explain that. Doo-Wop is a genre of music, of rock and roll music, that is disappearing. And that scared me, because programmers are not programming it. They feel it's too old, and anybody over 48 years old doesn't deserve any kind of enjoyment. They feel when you're over 48, according to yeah, you might as well watch them sit in the porch, watch them dig up the grass, ready to plant you, which is ridiculous, of course. Is that, you know, people in the 60s and 70s and even 80s, if they want to continue contributing to society, they should have that privilege. So I serve that batch of people in their late 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, up to 103, 104. After that, I don't understand it yet. Even though my contract runs long. Mel got me a contract that goes later than that. This book takes off from where that one left off. It's about 1962. This book is not in danger. This book is not an endangered species like Doo-Wop. Everybody's fascinated with the 60s so far. Really, they really are. So it's more of a scrapbook of what I went through. I live this. I literally live this as a young adult and as an adult. And it's a book of great, great photographs. It's music. It's rock and roll, this art form, which I'm very pleased that it's been recognized. Here I am in Washington, going to the National Press Club. Somebody said, hey, I guess the music's here to stay. Finally. Because in the early days, the journalists claimed they used to lock me in the basement of ABC in shackles, and let me off my radio show, feed me, put me back in again. We had a hard time at the beginning. But now it's a recognized art form. It's become an American poetry. And it's wonderful. So this book is a scrapbook of my emotion, my recollection, my living. And as I said, it's rock and roll. The music is the centerfold, and it's surrounded by the culture.
Well, you know, as I was going through the book, looking at the pictures, and fascinating pictures and great text, but I would go through and say, oh, yeah, all right, I've met this one, I've interviewed this one for their book, interviewed that one. And I was kind of impressed with myself that I met all these. And then I realized, you didn't just meet these people. You built these people. You're close friends with these people. These are people that you've helped create. I mean, you know, piddly little me, I just met them for 15 minutes, and these are people that you helped make stars.
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing when I hear people like you tell me that, because I don't think of it that way. I just think of it, you know, it's part of my life. Now, yeah, very involved with them, help them with their careers. I mean, I am sort of the, how would you say, I'm the bridge. I am so enamored and so jealous of the talent of some of these people, these poets, these publicists, these guys who produce, these guys who make the recordings, that I just sit back and I say, wow, am I a lucky man? So I'm like you are, really. Yeah, sure, I'm their friends. I got involved with them. I exposed the music. I had the privilege of exposing music to the public. But wow, what a fortunate, lucky man I am to have done this. What a career it's been. It's been a wonderful career. But like I always tell all these people, from Elvis to the Beatles to the Stones, you name them. Eric Clapton, and I'm throwing names at you, you know, and they say, thank you so much. You're so grateful to what I did. And I say, hold, stop. First of all, that's embarrassing, number one. Number two, I thank you, because I wouldn't be able to do what I'm doing without your poetry. You know, sure, I have a gift of being able to translate and able to communicate with people. That's a wonderful gift. But look what you're giving us. You're giving us, God gave you a gift, and I'm here to help you expose it to the world. That's it.
Now, are there purists who will quibble with the idea that you have put the Carpenters and John Denver in the same book as Eric Burdon and the Doors, you know, in a book on rock and roll?
And how about the Blue Cheer and a lot of punk rockers and heavy metal? Yeah, this was a thing I had to make a determination of. You know, it's funny, I have a list of my favorite 240 most influential musicians of the decade. How do you do that? The publisher said to me, can you give me a top 40 list? I said, absolutely not. How about a top 40,000? You know? So I narrowed it down to 240. It really wasn't fair. And it is really a salad bowl of music. Like you said, every genre, every kind of music. You know, rock and roll became rock, and it became a very complex animal. It's no longer very simple three chords. Right anymore. It's very complex. It's so complex that I don't understand some of it whatsoever. I mean, we're into hip-hop. We're into rap. We're into, you know, we still have simplistic rock and roll out there. We're into wonderful rhythm and blues. I believe, you know, it's coming around in a cycle again. I have a theory. And people always ask me, well, you know, who leads who? Does the music lead the art, or does the art lead the music? Which is the age-old argument. Here's my, and I'm going to talk about this at the press club. This is the Cousin Brucey rock and roll cycle. Life happens. Life is the beginning. This is it. The streets. Things happen. All kinds of events happen. The poets laud it. The journalists report it. The artists record it. Cousin Brucey exports it. And then it goes around again. So then it has an impact. So all this poetry that finally gets exposed after all the hullabaloo, the newspapers, and then the guys record it, and then it goes back to the public again, sociologically, and it has a great, great impact, if it's worthy of an impact, on the public. So that's what it's about. So rock and roll does not impact life. Life impacts art, always.
And by the time it comes back around to the public, there's some kid who says, oh, okay, let me try this with that.
Exactly. And also, say, politically, it comes back and they'll listen to the music on the air, especially during this 67, 68, the protest era that I write about in the book. Music had a great effect on the public. The entire nation was split down the middle. Some said, yeah, let's change things. Let's question everything. The others said, leave it alone. It ain't broke. Don't fix it, right? But music had a great effect on these people. And it always does. Music always has an effect.
After this short break, Bruce Morrow explains why parents' music can sometimes seem so different from kids' music.
Start your day with Now I've Heard Everything.
We post new episodes every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 5 o'clock a.m. Eastern Time.
Subscribe now so you'll have something fresh to listen to and get your day going.
Now back to my 2009 conversation with Bruce Morrow.
I've thought about this so many times, that the disconnect between us and our parents and their music was so much greater than the disconnect between me and my kids' music. I mean, there's a much narrower gap there. My kids and I, they're in their late 20s. We pretty much like the same kind of music. My parents and I, who I got along with famously on everything else, our music could have been more different.
Well, you know, I think we can blame that on media. Number one, the exposing of what we have to listen to today. Not only are we listening together, because back in 1958, we were on the radio, us playing these little, you remember, I don't know, you're probably too young, remember these little round things that were black with a hole in the middle called records, right? You remember that? I'm being a little facetious. Don't laugh. It happens. I'm with satellite radio with Sirius XM now, so my whole team that supports me with my radio shows, I say, hey, let's go tape it, guys, and it's dead air. Excuse me? Tape. What is tape? I said, oh my God, excuse me, let's digitally record, you know. So the whole world has changed. So the same thing with our parents and you and your children and me and my children. The entire dissemination process has changed. Radio has changed. We're now in this digital, the beginning, the tip of the digital iceberg. So now you and I are listening to things that our kids grew up with, and we're listening together. It's being delivered very differently. You don't have to kick the tires anymore. You can just push a button and grab the recording off the air and listen to a sample if you want. We did not also have as many possibilities of exposing the records as we do, or the music, or news in your field, you know, with information as we do today. I mean, today, how many different types of information exposing media that we have? We didn't have that. It didn't reach all over. I'm reaching the globe. My voice, and I'm sitting in this room, whoever thought at this tender age, Cousin Brucey will be reaching almost the globe. I mean, I'm reaching people in the Philippines. I'm talking from my New York studio. I'm talking to Hawaii, all over the nation, all over Canada. A guy called me from his boat in Guatemala Bay yesterday. I mean, this is amazing. Just think of this now. And we're delivering this music and this information with digital sound. It's gorgeous, gorgeous sound, and nobody's having a problem anymore. So sure, it's very different than our parents and than when we grew up. Today, we have this benefit. Mm-hmm. It's helped it.
And this podcast will outlive us both.
Absolutely. Yeah, I can understand that. A little scary, but I'll be listening. I will find a way to listen. I promise you.
But you know, there's so much criticism these days that everything is so corporatized. If the music itself isn't, then its delivery method is, unless you get some renegade in his basement who has an internet radio station of some kind. So much scorn has been heaped upon the RIAA these days. Free radio is about gone, they tell us. What is the future of rock and roll on whatever kind of delivery method?
Whatever delivery method will be. Right now, the delivery method we're talking about is satellite. And, of course, the reception methods that kids are using today with it's coming from the air somewhere, and I hear somebody put a quarter in a meter in his ear or something, and he's receiving it. It's kind of frightening. Where is it going? I agree with you. The word corporate is very much in our vocabulary today. People are doing corporate Woodstocks. They think they can. You know, what we had that is not available today is something called E-M-O-T-I-O-N, emotion. You cannot recreate an emotion with corporate offices. It does not happen. Money does not make the world go around anymore. Money will control the world going around. So what we don't have today in broadcasting especially is an emotional understanding. You know, we started this thing, Bill, and I'm sure you'll agree with me. We were flying by the seat of our pants, by our gut. People let us dream. And now, because it's become so big and it's so competitive, that the people we call, that my kids call in the suits upstairs, are afraid to let us dream a little bit. Once you stop young people from dreaming, you do not have any progress. You don't have any creativity. Creativity, I believe, has been stifled. If you listen to radio today, generally, it's stifled. Nobody's taking a chance to try to develop things.
But, you know, one thing that I took from your book is that no matter what era we're living in, the real people, the people who will really stand out in rock and roll are those who decided, all right, I know what the rules are, but I'm going to break them anyway, and I'm going to do this thing. And suddenly, they carve their own path. Your book is full of people like that.
Absolutely, because there'll always be dreamers. Mm-hmm. There'll always be us dreamers that say, hey, we have to do, you know, we have to do what we feel, not follow the avenue set out by our mm-hmm. forebears. Now, you know, I always believe, and I really believe this, that we learn from the preceding decade. Musicians, artists, poets, we do in our business, we learn from our guys who were there the preceding decades. Mm-hmm. And then we take it and develop. Take their best, take the best of them, and develop our own skills. And this is the way it has to be. Now, I believe right now we are in an era of being stifled. There are some of us that have the ability and the wherewithal to go in our own way. When I signed my deal with this satellite company, I insisted, number one, complete freedom. I can dream. I experiment. I play what I want. Nobody is allowed to go near my shows. And that to me is heaven. I never had that ever. Because it's kept at the very beginning when nobody knew what the heck I was doing or anybody else like me. Yeah, you know, I'm talking about the late 50s, early 60s. And then suddenly radio started making money and television started making money. And then the consultants came in and they said, thou shalt not do this. So we were stifled. We weren't allowed really to go beyond where they set up the boundaries. But I'm dreaming again. And I believe that radio, and we'll talk about, let's not pick on radio, broadcast itself, all broadcast. I believe now we're going to get into a new era of dreaming again. I think people are going to know. You know, the audience is so changed from those decades long ago when we were innocent. The audience has become extremely sophisticated. And the audience knows what they want to hear. They know good from bad. They know a cable show from a corporate-produced network, you know, tight show. I believe that we're going to learn to service the public again. Because I think what we forgot, we are so technically sound. We're so sophisticated. We're throwing, as I said, I talk to people in Guam, in Guatemala Bay. You know, that's nice. But what about giving them the proper poetry? What about the artistic? Where's the aesthetic? I believe now the corporate people are going to now give it back to us and say, okay, guys, we have it under control. Now I want you to show us what we have to do. It has to get back to the public again. We are in the business to service and serve the public good. I don't think we've been doing that for many years.
I also wanted to tell you something else. The other night, my wife and I, we were out at a restaurant looking through your book, which you brought along, looking through it. And our young waiter couldn't have been more than 24, 25 years old. He looked through. And there was a couple of people in there. He didn't recognize the picture. But I was pleasantly surprised at how many people, artists, this kid knew and was familiar with their music.
Well, you know, this decade of the 60s, as I said when we started talking, is a very alive and well. Very alive and well. Thanks to television and thanks especially to motion pictures. Movies have had a romance with this decade, the 60s. Now, the 60s, what about, what kind of decade was that? How did we survive it, number one? People say to me, boy, this is tough living here today. Kids will say, wow, this is so tough. I wish I was back in the 60s. And I said, let me tell you something. Let me tell you. I'm not putting or poo-pooing the decade now. It's a tough one. Economically, we're very in trouble. Politically, we're in trouble. We're in trouble with relationships. We're back in the I generation again, right? Back in the 60s, I said, it was the most turbulent of times. We had extreme racial issues, extreme political issues that would make this particular political time seem very calm, right? We had terrible social issues. We were really in trouble. And how we ever got out of it, I don't know. And I think one of the great ways we got out of it was something called music, rock and roll. Rock and roll soothed the savage beast. It also reported, as I said before, on what was happening in our lives. I mean, look, there's what I call the regular music, which music we just listen to for entertainment and listen to for lyric. It's love, you know, Moon, Spoon, June. But, of course, back in the 60s, a little more complex lyric. And then the reporting, the journalistic type music, the music that looked at life and reflected life, serious stuff, and had a great influence on the public. This is what I think got us through that decade.
Cousin Brucey, Bruce Morrow, is 86 now. Now you can get a copy of Rock and Roll and the Beat Goes On by Bruce Morrow by tapping on the link in our show notes or by going to our website, heardeverything.com. Now we may earn an Amazon commission if we make a purchase. Heardeverything.com is where you'll also hear my 2003 interview with someone who put together a similar book on some of the greatest hits of the last few decades, a 2003 conversation with Graham Nash.
His greatest dream was to attend the Soccer Cup final at Wembley Stadium. He never made it. So when Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young played Wembley Stadium in a concert, the first thing I did was go down onto the field and start kicking a ball around for my dad.
And my 1995 interview with another disc jockey who again, as Cousin Brucey did, helped shape so many careers, the great Wolfman Jack.
I remember when Elvis came out with his first record, Heartbreak Hotel. He was probably the only white artist on the whole program, and it was quite unusual to have a white artist doing rock and roll back in those days, you know.
And of course, we post new episodes here every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And you can find us everywhere you listen to podcasts. And thank you so much for listening. Next time on Now I've Heard Everything. We've all heard about Area 51. We've heard the rumors. We've heard the speculation. We've heard the wild conspiracy theories. But there's one person who used her investigative reporting skills to find out what really went on there. My 2011 interview with Annie Jacobson.
One source at Area 51 told me that actually the Soviets did manage to get a flying craft into our airspace, and that was the original hoax.
That's next time on Now I've Heard Everything. I'm Bill Thompson. Thank you.